This is Irredeemable, stories about Michigan juvenile lifers from Interlochen Public Radio.
I was somebody that you didn't want to see on the dark street.
If he told you it was bad, because everybody over there was selling drugs.
When I say I'm innocent, I mean that not only did I not murder the person that I'm in prison for, but I wasn't even there the day that the person was murdered.
And I am now 99.9% certain that Fred is innocent.
Most juvenile lifers we've talked to for this series accept responsibility for the murder they committed as a teen. And as Michigan resentences these prisoners, that's what they'll tell the court. But Fred Williams has been incarcerated for 16 years for something he says he did not do. And maintaining his innocence in court could put him at risk of never getting out. IPR's Morgan Springer has Fred's story.
In March 2001, Fred Williams left his friend Tanya Davis's house to get groceries. He was 17 and living on the west side of Detroit.
And so when Tanya said that she wanted to cook spaghetti for the day, I had two options. I had hometown groceries on Drury Road in Wyoming, or I had Foodorama on Livernois and Julian.
Fred chose Foodorama because he could sell drugs there.
You know, because I can buy this ingredients for the spaghetti and make a sale at the same time.
Fred had been selling drugs for about 3 years, mostly working under someone else. Fred made a drug sale, went into the store, and got the ingredients for spaghetti.
As I'm at the counter being served by the clerk, that's when I get tackled by these detectives.
The next thing he knows, Fred's at the police station being interrogated. They're saying he murdered a 40-year-old woman named Donna Houghton. Here's what happened to Donna Houghton. On January 17th, 2001, firefighters pulled her from a burning house on Joy Road. She was already dead. Not from the fire, though. She had been shot twice, once in the back, once in the head. Her roommate told police that before she jumped out her bedroom window to escape, she'd seen two men with a gun and a gas can. She heard the gunshots as she ran away from the house. Fred was held at the police station for more than a day. He kept insisting he didn't do it, but he was put in a lineup and picked out by the roommate. Then a homicide detective wrote a confession while Fred dictated.
He's writing it. At the time, I'm illiterate. I can't even write. I couldn't even write a statement at that time if I wanted to.
The confession said Fred went to Donna's house alone to collect $350 she owed him, but she said she didn't have the money, and then, quote, I started sprinkling gas around. Donna then came at me with a knife. I had a gun in my coat pocket, right pocket. I pulled it out and shot her, end quote. Fred says none of that is true. He's 34 now. He says he did go to the house a few weeks before with a friend to drop off money, but that was it. He says he gave his confession because he thought it was his best chance at a shorter prison sentence. While Fred was waiting for his trial, he called his mom. He told her he had $4,000 in savings hidden in her house, and he needed her to take that money and get him a lawyer.
And before I told her where it was at, you know, I asked her, you know, like, vow to me, promise me, you know, promise me that you're going to take this money, you're going to do the right thing with it. Like, there's no time to play around. Charging me with murder, first-degree murder, talking about giving me life. And, you know, she vowed to me. She's crying, Frederick, I promise. Just tell me where it's at. I'm about to go do it right now. And I told her where it was at. And she went and retrieved it. And she proceeded to spend it all getting high. She spent it all paying some of the drug debts that she had and purchasing more drugs to get high.
More than a year after Fred was arrested, he went to trial with a court-appointed attorney. He was found guilty of first-degree murder and arson and given the state's mandatory sentence, life without the possibility of parole. Fred's last act in the free world was a trip to the Foodorama to buy ingredients for spaghetti. He's been in prison ever since.
24-211, escort for one volunteer, please.
I met Fred at a writing workshop at Macomb Correctional Facility in 2015. He sat in a blue and orange jumpsuit in a conference room with eight other prisoners, all poets. They take turns reading something they've written. Here's part of what Fred read that day.
This is a journal entry, September 2015. Today is Mom's birthday. Sadly, I feel unaffected.
sad because I wish I could feel some sense of love for her. Of all the hardships you've put me through, I was looking forward to coming home from prison and building our relationship anew, but you died on me. But I want you to know I've changed my life in a positive way. I'm educated now. I'm drug free. I embrace my emotions. I'm in love with a beautiful girl. I'm anti-violence. I'm a published poet. I'm friendly. Because of you, I now appreciate good parenting. The responsibility of having another human life in your hands is not to be fumbled. I miss you, Mama, but you fumbled.
Fred was transferred to Marquette Branch Prison in the Upper Peninsula recently. But after years of being told he was going to die in prison, Fred now has reason to hope. 5 years ago, a U.S. Supreme Court ruling said, giving juveniles who commit murder a mandatory life sentence is cruel and unusual punishment. Another ruling after that said Michigan and 27 other states with similar laws had to give these juvenile lifers a shot at a second chance. In Michigan, that means resentencing. Under the new rules, Fred could serve a minimum of 25 years or he could get life again. The court will look at many factors when deciding how long Fred's punishment should be. One is his upbringing, acknowledgement that juvenile lifers like Fred can be a product of an environment they didn't choose. Fred says his life got pretty serious when he was around 6 years old and his parents got addicted to crack cocaine.
While they smoked drugs, they had a sheet to cover the entrance of the kitchen. So they would be cooking drugs and selling drugs and smoking drugs in the kitchen. And we were supposed to be good little kids and sit there and watch cartoons. Well, always, sometimes my sister and I and my little brother, we would sneak around the living room until where we could see what was going on in the kitchen. And I don't know, it was a learning experience, whether people realize it or not, you're learning as a kid, whether you're learning to read, whether you're learning to play basketball, softball, or cook crack and sell crack, you're learning. And so that's what my learning experience was, drugs and violence.
When Fred was 8 or 9, his dad got pneumonia, but he still had to go out into a blizzard to sell drugs. One day he came into the house to warm up.
He sat on his little recliner, and he put his feet up, and he never woke up from there.
The next time Fred saw his dad was at his funeral. By age 14, Fred had taken the night shift on the corner, selling drugs for the same guy his dad had worked for before he died.
I sold crack, I sold heroin, I sold marijuana, I robbed people, I broke in houses, I stole cars, I sold parts from cars. Yeah, I was the most involved in the underworld pretty heavy.
When Fred was sent to prison for life, he didn't leave the underworld. In 2009, 8 years into his incarceration, Fred stabbed another prisoner in the face with a makeshift knife during a fight and was sent to segregation for months. There, he took time to reflect.
And I'm like, man, I have to make a change. Like, I need to grow up.
He found out he could get books delivered from the library to segregation. One of the first books he requested was the Norton Reader.
And the Norton Reader encompassed instructions on how to conduct yourself as a man and how not to.
This was the beginning of Fred's evolution, rehabilitation. That's another important factor Michigan courts will consider during Fred's resentencing hearing. Fred's earned his GED. He's taken college classes. He paints and makes bracelets. And he's facilitated poetry and reading groups. Still, these accomplishments are not enough. At least that's what Wayne County Prosecutor Kim Worthy said. She's asking the court to still keep Fred in prison for life. She's basically saying Fred is irredeemable or, in legalese, irreparably corrupt. Her office declined an interview. This recommendation does not determine the resentencing outcome, but Fred's fight to get out of prison will be harder. And Fred has another problem. He'll likely do better at resentencing if he accepts responsibility for the crime. Valerie Newman is Fred's attorney. She works for the Michigan State Appellate Defender Office and has practiced law for more than 25 years.
There is a tension that people don't understand between maintaining your innocence and trying to achieve your freedom. Because maintaining his innocence is at odds with what the courts and the prosecutor want, which is acceptance of responsibility as a sign of rehabilitation and growth and maturity.
Valerie says Fred has a tortured choice to make. He can say he killed Donna, show remorse, and hope for a reduced prison sentence, or he can maintain his innocence and risk staying in prison for life. This is a strategic decision most juvenile lifers do not face because they've admitted their guilt.
You know, so it's not an easy decision to make, especially in a case like this where, you know, we don't know that we're going to be able to prove it at this stage. And it's something that Fred and I have discussed at length about his case.
Right, and she said she told me out her own mouth, like, it's ultimately my decision, which course I wanted to take, you know. And, you know, everyone says it's the best thing for me to do is, you know, just, like, swallow the pill and take the juvenile life out, but I don't want to.
Like, who's saying that to you?
Everybody. I mean, all of my friends in here, like, we have these conversations because we talk about each other's cases and appeals and going home. And like all of the guys here, you know, like we're seeing juvenile lifers go home. And so the guys are like, man, you know, we may point someone out who's in a wheelchair who's been in here for 50 years filing appeals, trying to wait on an appeal. And it's kind of like, do you want to be the guy who's going home or do you want to be the guy who's here in the wheelchair 50 years later? Still saying he's innocent. And I'm like, I don't know if that guy's innocent or not, but I know where I was, and I know what I didn't do. But honestly, I don't want to get up. I don't want to get up there and say I did it. I don't want to get up there and take responsibility for it because it means a lot to me, man. Like to murder a woman over $350 to be a part of murdering someone and setting them on fire. It's not like I've done some things. Like I'm not a choir boy. I'm not, you know, I'm not an angel or anything. But like that's not who I am. That's not me. I didn't do it, and so I shouldn't have to say that I did it just to get out of prison.
There are two main pieces of evidence against Fred. There's his confession of guilt, and there's the eyewitness identification by the roommate, Yolanda Trotter. In both cases, there are questions about how valid the evidence is. For one, Trotter says when the cops called her to come see Fred's lineup, they told her they had the guy. Eve Primus is a professor at University of Michigan Law School.
If the police suggest to the witness that they've caught the guy, it puts pressure on the witness to pick that person or to pick a person out of whatever lineup or identification procedure the police show the individual. So it absolutely is a problematic procedure to employ.
A Detroit Police Department spokesman declined comment for this story, but in trial transcripts, the police officer denies telling Trotter the main suspect was in the lineup. Another problem is Yolanda Trotter picked someone else out of the lineup first, not Fred, and then she picked Fred. She says that's because she was nervous. She told me this summer, quote, Fred is guilty as sin. He's saying what he's saying. I'm saying what I know. I asked her, do you have any shadow of a doubt? She said, I am 98.9% sure. Then there's Fred's confession. First of all, the facts in it don't quite match up with the evidence. On top of that, Fred's claiming the confession was made up. Professor Primus says that does happen.
It's actually much more plausible than people realize. In the studies of exonerations based on DNA evidence, in the first 250 exonerations, 40 of those individuals had falsely confessed.
The National Registry of Exonerations makes a similar point. Fred's resentencing hearing is not scheduled yet. His best case scenario, he'd get the minimum sentence and serve 9 more years in prison. But he'd still be a convicted felon.
I'll take it. I'm not going to be foolish, but that's not what I want. It's not how I want to come home. I want to be vindicated.
And there is a chance Fred could be vindicated. He has one other legal option. In addition to the juvenile resentencing, his attorney can open a completely separate innocence case. They need new, compelling evidence to do that. And this summer, his attorney, Valerie Newman, says she found something. She says she thinks they've solved the crime, but she still needs more details for a strong innocence case. Fred's childhood friend, Chantel, told him once, even though you're in prison, you're doing better than most of the men from our neighborhood.
Man, it's hard to imagine what I would have become had I not came to prison. It's hard to imagine what situation I would be in, whether I would even be alive. My everyday company, man, no one has been successful. And I don't even mean material success. I just mean like a peaceful state. Like everyone who I know who I was with on a daily basis are in prison or dead or hiding from police or running from police. Still living in the world of crime. It makes me want to say yes, that I was better off coming to prison. But I hate prison so strongly. I have such a strong disdain for prison that I just can't allow myself to say it.
That story was produced by Morgan Springer. It was edited by Peter Payette. We had help from Rob Rosenthal and Bob Campbell. I'm David Castleman. You can see pictures of Fred and listen to some of his poetry at our website for the series, irredeemable.org. You can also catch up on the first few stories in our series if you missed them. Again, the website is irredeemable.org. You're listening to Morning Edition on IPR News Radio.